Welcome to the CG Pro podcast. This is episode 69 with John Wainick. And if you enjoy what you hear today, you can follow us at becomecgpro.com or in our private Facebook group. So, yeah, today's episode, we're very looking forward to this. This is John Wainick. John is a technical environment art lead at Intrepid. And he's currently working in the games industry, but he's had a lot of different experiences throughout his career. It's a very interesting, varied career, working through film, working on projects like Mandalorian, and then also in the games industry as these two industries kind of start to converge at this point, but also worked in IT and various other tech roles. So I'll leave it there and just say, hey, John, it's great to have you here.
Hey, yeah, it's good to be here. Finally, I feel like this was a long time coming.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and one thing I missed is that John heads up our games division at CG Pro. So another string to John's bow. But great to have you here.
Oh yeah, it's definitely good to be here. Definitely good to be here. Something that you forgot though, not just games and film, but also the simulation industries as well.
Right. Yeah.
So I've seen Unreal Engine used in so many different scenarios, from video games to, up on an LED wall at Manhattan Beach Studios, all the way down to, you know, VR training. Even I've watched a team use Unreal Engine to control a drone before. It's just awesome. All sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, it's an incredible kind of tech CG hub that can do all kinds of stuff. And I'm looking forward to getting into that more as we chat. I'd love to hear a little bit about how you got here and were there some kind of early indicators early in your life that computer graphics was the thing? Were there some games or films that inspired you and how did you get here?
I think it really started at a super young age, because my grandparents, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents when I was like 3 or 4 years old, and they thought it was really, really important that a four-year-old learns to read, you know, starts to learn how to read. And so obviously one of the best ways to do that for a child like that is through comic books. So I got really into comic books, and one day, and I love this story, is one day I was 4 years old, almost five, I was reading a Spider-Man comic, and I did not like the way that the issue ended. I couldn't stand it. And I went and I complained to my grandma about it. And she's like, her solution, her answer was, well, why don't you redo it? And then I got some paper, I got some, you know, pencils and colored pencils and everything. And then from that point on, I knew that I was not only an artist, but a storyteller as well. And I really stuck with drawing for a long time. And I was going to get in. I wanted to be a comic book artist initially. But one of my junior high art teachers, he pulled me aside one day and he said, you're great at this. You know, you're really good. I love your comic art, but don't do it. Please don't do it. Being a comic book artist, you're in a sweatshop, you know, and you're not really getting appreciated. Somebody else's name is going to be put on your stuff, and you're never going to get, you know, the recognition that you want. That was soul crushing, dream crushing, obviously. But then I kind of stuck with it still. And my neighbor, he actually gifted me a copy of Photoshop for my birthday. And from there, that got me into the digital side of things. I was in high school and things were starting to convert over to 3D in terms of games. And I started to get into 3D Studio Max, playing around with that a little bit, started thinking, oh, hey, you know, maybe if I can't be in comic books, maybe I can be in movies. And so just thinking about translating that art to 3D, something that could be up on the screen, that was really powerful right there. And I knew I was going to do something with that. But then something else happened. One day I just kind of got tired of making these still images, these still renders in 3D Studio Max. And I thought, hey, I want these to do something. I tried animation. I was not very good at it. Like I got the concepts. I've even taught classes on some of the basic concepts, but I always felt that I didn't find excitement in the actual animating of things. But I did think about games, and that's when I started to teach myself how to do a little bit of programming, because I wanted to take my 3D art and then make it do something. And then from there, I just have this kind of ADHD going back and forth of, you know, I like doing film. Oh, I like doing games. Like, oh, no, I like doing the simulation side of things. Oh, I like bringing them all together. And one of the cool things is that today, like where we're at today, the divide, the lines between them are so blurred that, you know, I feel like it's possible not only for me to do that, but for anybody to really do it at this point.
Did you, in the early days of trying to figure this out and being curious about all of these different disciplines and industries, did you study? Did you self-teach, mix of the two?
I started self-teaching, and then I tried to seek out education. I started going to college, took a game design course in college, and didn't really get much out of it. There was a lot of math, English, you know, science, all the like core stuff in there that were really good classes, but the actual like game classes were not that great. And I think it's because things were still early. You know, it was one of the few schools at the time that had any kind of game art opportunities available that they were trying to teach. And I don't think they knew how to teach it at that point, which I think was one of the things that initially inspired me to get into teaching too, was, you know, seeing how poorly it was being done. Not saying that teachers were bad, it's just they didn't know how to do it. So just seeing that kind of inspired me to want to do it better, I think. But after I did that, that's when Noman came in, Noman School of Visual Effects. And I learned so much so quickly through that, that, you know, before I knew it, you know, here I am. I had been using 3D Studio Max for a while, and then I hated Maya because I thought it was just the dumbest interface in, you know, anywhere. Now I am an avid Maya user, and I won't use anything else. Like, you know, I know people say get on Blender, but I mean, I'm a Maya user, and that's partly because of Noman, Alex Alvarez over at Noman. You know, he taught me intro to Maya, and you know, that was kind of the rest was history there. But I think Noman was definitely the thing that really taught me the most. But then, of course, after that, you know, that taught me the 3D art side. But after that, a lot of it ended up being self-taught. And one of the things that drove me to self-teach a lot was the fact that people started pulling me in to tutor classes, to be teacher's assistants in some of these classes. I got pulled aside to teach some of my own classes very early on. I've been teaching probably since like 2012, I think. And a lot of the times it was, oh, I know that there's something cool that can be done. I want to show other people how to do it, but I don't actually know how to do it myself. Or one of my students would come to me and they would ask me, it's like, well, how do I do this? And my response would always be, let me get back to you tomorrow. And then I would go and I would teach myself how to do that thing. I would research, I would look on, you know, YouTube, documentation, books that I had, you know, the Epic Games forums, all sorts, anywhere that I could find information. And then I would teach myself how to do that thing so that the next day I could go and teach somebody else how to do it.
Right. Yeah, it's one of the gifts of teaching, right, is that you have to learn things very quickly. Oh,
yeah.
Sometimes,
yeah, and have to stay on top of things yourself,
right? Yeah, which is what keeps it interesting as well.
Yeah, so for sure.
First off, did you initially work in games, or what did you do first, and kind of after your learning?
Games first, then simulation. Spent a lot of time with VR and simulation, and then a little bit of games again, then film, then or virtual production, I should say, then back to games with an idea that, you know, taking on some VP projects sometime in the near future.
Right. What's it been like over the course of your career? I mean, seeing the changes that have happened in the technology, and I know that when I was starting out in visual effects, you kind of had to choose Bill and Ted style, choose your eternity and which path you want to take, and like, you know, stick to it for the rest of your life kind of vibe. But I know now that finally people are jumping across those divides more. What's it been like watching the evolution of that technology?
It's been really interesting, because I recall in the beginning when I first started to pursue it, one of the guys that talked me into pursuing it in the first place, you know, told me that, you know, it's a very specialized industry. We were talking about film at the time. And it was like, you have people that do one thing. You have a guy that does just textures. That's all he does. You have a guy that does the modeling. You have a guy that takes those textures and turns them into materials and puts them on the model. And that was three different people to make one asset, you know, to make one prop. And it was very specialized. And where it's translated to at this point, where we're at now, I feel like it's more generalist. The more generalist you have in your toolkit, the better off you are in trying to get a job, especially if you're trying to break in. Because now I remember working on a project where it was exactly like that. I was the modeler, and then, you know, somebody else did textures, and then somebody else put those materials together and put them on the model, and then somebody else put them in the engine. But now, you know, I look over here at work, and, you know, I've got one single artist that is doing the modeling, the texturing, setting up the materials, importing it into Unreal, setting up the blueprint for it, all of that. So it's a lot more generalist welcoming now. I remember in the beginning it was, you know, oh, you're a generalist, you're a jack of all trades. Well, you're not really that useful, because we need people that specialize in something. I feel like it's kind of the opposite now, especially now that we have things like virtual production, where, you know, the film side of things, you know, the more and more things are having their backgrounds thrown up on an LED volume wall. And, you know, it's like, to be able to do that, you need people that understand. So maybe all you do in your job is modeling or sculpting or whatever, but you need to understand the whole process, especially when it comes to things like performance and, you know, best practices for that, because that's going to help the next guy in the line, and it's going to help keep the whole project together. And it's just, I think it's beautiful. I think it's, but that could be me and, you know, my ADHD and the fact that I have always been a jack of all trades, like always doing everything and jumping into everything. So I think it's beautiful. Other people might think it's overwhelming, but, you know, there are certain things that, you know, once you do them for a while, they become second nature. Like I hadn't even opened Substance Painter in probably 6 months, because I wasn't doing any personal projects with it. I was doing mostly lighting and performance stuff at work. And then just the other day, I opened up Substance Painter and just got right to it and started having some fun. So it's like riding a bike. So you just learn how to ride different bikes.
And they all have things in common. It's really cool. We're definitely getting some interesting comments appearing in the chat. By the way, everybody who's watching, we are live, unless you're hearing this recorded. So feel free to ask questions to John. Post them in the chat there. But yeah, really, people are really enjoying this idea of generalism, because I was told at the beginning of my career that you should choose your specialism. And in film, it was probably the right piece of advice at the time, because it was more specialist driven and had been more compartmentalized into different disciplines. What do you think are some of the reasons for the rise of generalism today?
I think money, budget is a big one. If you've got, you know, one person that can do, that can wear multiple hats, then, you know, that's one person that you're paying versus two people. I remember, so like right now, I consider myself a technical environment artist, which means that I'm an environment artist that also does some of the tech art kind of stuff. And I was doing that for a while, but I didn't, there wasn't really a name for it until probably like, oh, I want to say it was like 6 or 7 years ago, when I was on a call with a recruiter actually that was for 343 Studios, and he was talking to me about this position called technical environment artist. I'd never heard of it before. Nobody'd ever heard of it before, and basically what it came down to, and the way it was kind of explained to me, was, well, so we could have an environment artist and we could have a tech artist, both of them making a certain amount of money. And that tech artist is not doing like the full, the whole tech art spectrum. They're just doing something specific for the environment. Or they could hire the environment artist that knows how to do this stuff, pay them a little bit more, and they're saving more money than, you know, if they hired both of those people. But then also, I think, oversaturation. One big thing that came up with that was a few years ago, I was teaching an environment artist program, game art program. And, you know, one of the things was like these students would come in with all of these dreams and they're like, I want to be an environment artist. I want to do all this. But there was the problem that a company would post a job. And then as soon as they post that job, they get like 800 applications in a week. And so there you were, you have all these people that are really, really talented, because I think people are getting more and more talented. And I think a lot of that has to do with the tools getting easier to use as well, but also just, you know, people are getting more talented. So you have 800 talented people applying for this job, and that has to be narrowed down to one or two people. And then so everybody needs a little bit of a leg up. One of the things that I always used to teach in my environment class was, you know, don't just do static images, make a video, make a cinematic, you know. But also, one big thing that was helping students get jobs was when they learned how to do some of the more technical stuff. They learned how to do, like in Unreal, how to do Blueprint. They learned a little bit more on the optimization side. Perforce, I taught a Perforce class. So I've had leads from everywhere from Blizzard to Microsoft, Naughty Dog, Ubisoft, all of them email me and say, thank you for teaching so-and-so how to use Perforce. You just saved us 2 weeks. You know, so we didn't have to bring this person on and teach them how to use Perforce on the job. They were able to come in, knew what to do right away, and then they were able to, you know, they were able to start to get to work essentially right away. So it's like having those technical skills, having those extra skills, the more you had, the more attractive you looked up against, you know, 799 other people.
Got it. What, and so in that, being that people are becoming more capable and the tools are becoming more accessible, how do you stand out today? Let's say in games, because I know it's probably different in, or maybe a little bit, how do you stand out in games and how do you stand out in film?
So how do you stand out in games? Showing things in motion, really. And I don't mean just like having cinematics or anything, but in games, for example, one big thing with games is performance. You know, you have to, there's a lot of performance optimization. So you need to be able to show something beautiful in your portfolio, but a good way to stand out is if you can show it in the process of, you know, playing through it. And you don't have to have anything fancy with like fancy characters and, you know, major game mechanics or anything like that. But if you can, like, if you want to be an environment artist, I know I talk a lot about environment art, but that's my specialty there. But if you want to be an environment artist and you show your environment in your portfolio, but you also show a video of running through it, even with the default Unreal mannequin, you know, running through it, doing a couple of things, and, you know, you see that really smooth frame rate, that right there is going to be really, really attractive to anybody doing hiring, you know, specifically because of the fact that with games, you're trying to hit that frame rate. You want that smooth frame rate when you're playing through it. And so, you know, it's being able to show that you can achieve that smooth frame rate is telling the recruiters and the interviewers that, oh, you know about optimization, you know about how to make it look good, but also run good at the same time. And you just save them like 45 minutes of an interview process. You save them, you know, 2 months of a, you know, probational period process of, do they really know what they're doing or not? Because you can have a lot of really good looking stuff, or a lot of really pretty stuff in your portfolio. But if it doesn't run well, then, you know, that's not going to be good for games. You're going to have to learn really quickly how to optimize and, you know, still make it look good. But then on the film side, you know, I think understanding cinematography, I think, is a big, big part there. Knowing cameras, knowing lights, understanding, you know, like you see, you have an image, you know, you have a scene, you know, do you have depth of field in it? You know, do you have like proper, you know, lighting setups in it? Do you understand how to achieve that depth of field? Is it a filter that you put on there, or do you actually understand, you know, how the aperture, you know, versus the actual zoom on your camera works? You know, demonstrating that you understand those things in cinematography is going to be really, really important, because especially if you're getting into virtual production, then you're going to be making things for a background. And I know that doesn't sound sexy at all, but, you know, that's the truth of it. And I remember one time, it was on Ahsoka, where the team had put together this this environment for one of the scenes of the show. And I remember our DP came in and we were doing a virtual scout, and he looked at it and he was like, oh, this is going to look so good out of focus. Which you hear that, you know, initially, and it's like, oh man, that's soul crushing. You know, it's, you're going to take all my hard work and this, you're going to blur it out. But the thing is that understanding how the camera works, you would understand that you can't just take a bunch of like solid shapes or whatever, like low resolution artwork, blur that out and get that, you know, that good bokeh, that good, you know, feel with it. The more realistic it is before the depth of field, before the bokeh, before the blur, you know, the better it's going to look out of focus. And that's a big part of it there.
So what's it been like for you then, making that jump and going between the two, going from games to then working in film? What were some of the things that you had to learn that you didn't know? What were some of the challenges?
That right there, cameras. I knew a little bit, you know, I had cameras, and, you know, I understood what an f-stop was and everything, but I think it was the thing that I learned really quickly, getting very close with the DPs on the virtual production side, was cameras. And that inspired me to go out and start getting my own cameras and, you know, starting to get more into cinematography myself. And I think it inspired me to get out there and start doing some filming of things on my own in the real world, which I was then able to bring back. And I feel like it made my CG art better. It made my art direction better, when I was leading projects. And to be honest, it was really scary at first. Because I remember I got, and I think it was a message on ArtStation, actually, from a recruiter, basically, you know, saying that, you know, our people have seen your portfolio and they love it. And, you know, they want to know, you know, how in the world did you get this to look this good and run performantly? And then so I was confident in that. You know, I could talk about that because I've been doing that for game stuff for a while. And then they pull me on into the virtual production side of things. And I realized really quickly that one of the reasons that they brought me in the first place was to educate, to teach, you know, the team how to get the best out of the game engine, you know, how to optimize for, you know, some of these really, really big scenes. Like we had a scene, Ahsoka's out now, I can talk about it. We had a scene in Ahsoka, the Corellia shipyards, that was just insane. It was a massive scene, massive amount of detail, millions and millions and millions of triangles, and like needed to figure out how do we get that to run. You know, how do we get it to run in VR so they can do virtual scouting? You know, how do we not give Dave Filoni and John Favreau motion sickness, you know, in this this virtual scout? How do we get this running up on the volume wall and looking good? And that's where I got to come in and be like, okay, well, if we were doing this for a game, we would do this. We would do this with layered materials. We would build things modularly this way. We would use these techniques to make that modular not look repetitive, all of that. And I was able to come in and teach people how to do that. And then we were able to pull off that set and then some other pretty massive sets. And then there's another show that I can't talk about yet because it's not out yet, but they tried to push it even further. And those, you know, those techniques became really, really important on the film side. So I felt like I learned a lot, but then also I got to share a lot too.
Right. That was a lot of education, which I guess fit nicely into the fact that you've done a lot of that. You've done a lot of teaching throughout your career. What, how's it evolving? Because essentially the game engines now are trying to remove the need for some of the optimization work, but at the same time, we're still having to do it a lot. What's that like these days?
They're trying, but I also feel like it's becoming too easy for people to expect to rely on it. One of the biggest examples there, I think, would be Nanite with Unreal Engine 5. You know, they did the initial marketing announcement of Unreal Engine 5, and it's like, oh, hey, Nanite. You know, and somebody on there on the video said, yeah, you just, you know, you can take your model straight out of ZBrush and drop it into Unreal Engine. And no, you can't. No, don't ever do that. Don't ever do
technically
that.
Technically, you can.
Technically, you can. Technically, you can. Technically, you can. But don't do it because it's not, you know, it's not good. I actually immediately after that did a 2-part YouTube video on that topic right there. So what Nanite actually is really a replacement for the level of detail system from Unreal Engine 4. And it's a replacement for that. And how it does it is instead of thinking of things on a basic asset level, it takes the entire scene into context and then renders out those triangles in a specific way to, you know, decide what level of detail every triangle needs to be depending upon where you're looking. Now, what that means is that you can get away with having much denser geometry, like much higher poly count models in a scene, and it still run really well. But there are two main things that you have to worry about. One, the most important, is size on disk. Now, that's not as important when you're doing film, because the virtual production side of things, they're going to throw the project on a portable SSD, load it up, and then, you know, when it's done, the next project, it's a new SSD, you know. On the game side of things, you know, these huge geometrically detailed meshes, you know, you pull something out of ZBrush and you bring it in, okay, it's gonna look great, but it's also that one asset might be, you know, 50 to 100 megabytes on disk. And then suddenly for your video games, doing a bunch of stuff like that, you end up with, you know, 500 gigabyte game installs. Working on a project recently, like our install was going to be about 600 gigabytes. And, you know, you can't have that. We have bigger hard drives these days. We have more storage space that's cheaper and easier to get, but nobody wants to take up half to all of their hard drive just for, you know, one game. So the size on
you have to download it as well, usually.
Yeah. Yeah. Your bandwidth, all that. And that's something that you have to take in consideration, is that size on disk. But then the other thing is that when they're huge like that, we actually, on a project, were experimenting with something, and we had something that was like 1.3 million triangles, and it was nanite, and we dropped it in, and it ran okay. But then when we needed to make an edit to it in the static mesh editor, double click it to open it up, and Unreal would crash every single time. We were unable to actually open it until one person got lucky, and that person, you know, was like, okay, delete, so we can re-import it. But the thing is that you can get a lot of detail in there with a lot of geometry, but you can still get that same exact level of detail with much less geometry a lot of the time. So you might go in there and, you know, you'll have something that is really, really, really detailed, and you might have like a 500,000 triangle version, and you might have a 50,000 triangle version, and you can't really tell the difference when you're looking at it from the perspective that you're going to be looking at it. Maybe if you get up real close, you know, where you're, you know, right on it, where it's like, you know, it's like right here in front of your face, then you'll notice. But when you're looking at it from the perspective that whether it's a game or a film, where your camera is going to be looking at it, you know, there's no visual difference there. Plus you have normal maps and everything like that you can use for it. And so do you need that much geometry? No, you don't. Can you relax a little bit on, you know, your triangle counts and things like that? Yeah, you can. You definitely can. It used to be, you know, you would have an asset and you would have a budget for it. And then the question, you know, would always be, you know, what's my budget? You know, how many triangles can I use on this? And I think what's really powerful with nanite is that the answer to that question is however many you need, but no more, no less. And it's what it is it's however many triangles you need to be able to capture the silhouette, and then maybe any medium detail. So something that you used to try to make is like a 2000 triangle asset. Yeah, it's okay if it's, you know, 15,000 triangles now, but there's no need to make it 80,000 triangles. You know, you're not really getting as much gain as you might think. You know, you might look at it and be like, oh, I can tell, but, you know, your audience is not going to be able to. Right. And that's the thing there. So optimization is definitely still a thing.
Great answer. Yeah, I've got more questions about that, but I want to take some from our audience, and I've got a few queuing up here. So let's take some of these down. Somebody's asking, let's ask this one first. How do you feel about asset creation across platforms, for example, between film and games environments for LED, virtual production, and UEFN with the same assets? Coming from a Unity dev background, I don't know if that's the same question.
I think that's a different one.
A different question. In that case, yeah. Just that first one.
Okay, so this first one here, the asset creation across film, games, virtual production, Unreal Engine for Fortnite, all of that. It's not that different, I don't think. I think a lot of what we can do with, you know, general games now, general 3D games, if you're pushing realism, is you can make them a little bit more higher resolution in geometry. Maybe you can do a little bit higher resolution on your textures, you know, and then the virtual production side, you know, if you wanted to use the same asset, I remember working on a VP project where we actually pulled some assets from a game and use them in our scene that ended up on the volume wall. And then Unreal Engine for Fortnite is still basically Unreal Engine. You know, maybe you want it to be a little stylized or whatever, if that's what you're going for. But ultimately, the big thing, I love this question so much, and I actually get asked about it a lot. You know, what's the difference between making assets for, you know, virtual production versus game, you know, whatever? There's not as much difference as you think. Like, going into it, if you're custom making models, then, you know, you want to take into consideration the best practice techniques that are going to work across everything, understanding things like, you know, trim sheets and, you know, mirroring UVs, using atlases, things like that, you know, using as few materials as possible, only using as much texture resolution as you need. All of these things that anybody who works in games is very familiar with. Like, you work in games, like, yeah, you know, trim sheets, you know, all these optimization techniques. So those are really important for the virtual production side or Unreal Engine for Fortnite side as well, because understanding those, you're going to be able to pull out a lot of good visual quality while still keeping, you know, performance in check, which if you have what we call keep alive in a virtual production scene, for example, that would be like, you know, foliage blowing in the wind or any kind of special effects or anything like that. You know, those are going to be reliant on having a solid frame rate. So doing that kind of optimization is really important, but that doesn't mean that you're going to get less visual fidelity out of it. It just means you need to learn the specific techniques that have been employed in the game industry for 20 years to try and pull the most visual quality out of it with just these little tricks, all kinds of little tricks for that.
It's interesting as well, thinking from a visual effects perspective, that it's not entirely new to that community. Even with rendering offline, with render farms, you would still run into the situation where your renders are taking too long and therefore have to optimize, not to the extent that you do in a game. But I think, yeah, it's interesting seeing how these are borrowing from each other and learning from each other. The games has been learning from film for a while to bring up the visual fidelity, and film's been now learning a lot from games.
Oh yeah.
So next question, someone says, coming from a Unity game dev background with amateur 3D skills, where should I focus if I'm trying to break into virtual production? I'm quite a generalist, but should I focus more on film, past cinematography, and into color grading, or am I better off stopping after C, or am I better off stopping after cinematography, I should say, and leaning back into modeling and texturing?
Okay, so coming from a Unity game dev background, probably already have a decent sense of some of the optimization techniques that you have to do when it comes to modeling and texturing. getting into it. Now, I've heard all the time that Unreal Engine is too hard to learn, or, you know, Unity is easier to learn than Unreal, all of that. It's not. Unreal is actually really, really easy to learn. And, you know, I have very consistently, since Unreal Engine 4 came out, taught people how to work in Unreal Engine very easily in a day. Like, it's not that hard to learn. It's just overwhelming because it's a, you know, a bigger piece of software. So, but once you learn like the basic UI, the navigation, all of that, and then how to import your files and how, you know, how the models and textures and materials get put together and everything, you know, then that's really all you need to know on the virtual production side when it comes to Unreal, because a lot of what you do in virtual production is what's called layout art. So just knowing how to get around, basically, which is really easy to learn. So I wouldn't worry about that. We have resources for that. I even have a YouTube channel that will teach you how to use Unreal in less than an hour. So that part's easy, but the focusing on the cinematography side, you know, is going to be important. Get a feel for what you can with cameras. I wouldn't worry too much about the color grading side of it just yet, but just learn cameras, learn how your aperture and your shutter speed and your ISO all work together to create an image. You know, understand that triangle there, and then, you know, really start improving upon your texturing techniques in terms of like understanding like some of the optimization stuff and all of that, because that's going to be important for, you know, getting assets in and being able to use them and have them be performant in a scene. So a little bit just the basics of UE, how a camera works, so that you understand things like depth of field and stuff like that, and how the light works with everything. And then once you understand that, learning things like cameras in Unreal actually becomes easier, because Unreal just uses normal camera stuff. You know, you can change the aperture on a camera, you can change the ISO on it for your exposure, you can change the shutter speed and all of that. So that'll just translate over. It's just, you know, learning how, what buttons to click basically to get there. But I would not worry too much about any fear of trying to learn Unreal. Cause like I said, you know, getting in there to be able to do layout art, not too terribly difficult. So, just a little bit of cinematography and really improve on your modeling and texturing skills, because a big important thing there that a lot of people don't think about is, you know, there's a lot of photogrammetry in virtual production, and I could talk hours about that topic, but there are still people that are making bespoke assets, people that are still building architectural stuff, because, you know, you can't scan everything. There's a lot of things that in order to scan them, you would have to build them in reality. And it's a lot more budget friendly to just model them in 3D than to build them and then, you know, go scan them and then clean it up and then make a model over that. Anyways.
Which is the workflow for some art departments that have enough money to do it. They will literally do that.
Oh yeah. I've worked with those art departments.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it's definitely not everybody's budget for sure. Got a couple more really interesting questions here. And then I've got some more too. I was wondering how much you can relax with Nanite. Does it really help with how much you have to think about polycam, or do you pretty much still do the same process for optimization?
I would say you can relax a lot more than you might think. You still have to do optimization, but not to the same level. It's really it was like I was saying earlier, you know, used to be you'd have to optimize this thing down to 2,000 triangles. Now, if it takes 15,000 triangles to, you know, capture the silhouette and get the detail that you need, then you know, that's fine. Definitely don't just throw your high poly in there and expect that to be the end of it. Who wants to do that anyway? Because who wants to UV a high poly? Nobody wants to UV a high poly.
Nobody wants to UV full stop.
I've had to do it before. I've had to UV a high poly before. And you know how I UV a high poly? I've actually got a YouTube video on this. I make a low poly, UV that, and then transfer the UVs to the high poly. Which at that point I've made the low poly, so why don't I just use that with a normal map? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's definitely you don't have to have anxiety over your triangle count, I would say, but definitely you do want to think about optimization. Don't use triangles just for the sake of using triangles, but you know, if it's a curve, it should look like a curve. A circle should look like a circle. A sphere should look like a sphere. You shouldn't see any faceting on a curve. But does a straight line need to be super high poly? No, you can have two vertices right here and you can capture that that straight line just the same. So
it's really cool starting to see some of the things that we've enjoyed in visual effects for a long time, particularly displacement and tessellation, and being able to do what you're saying and have low poly assets be the things that are thrown around and downloaded and stored on disk, but more of that detail coming from textures, which can give you the detail with less overhead.
And that's the great thing about tessellation, which I'm glad that they've brought it back for landscapes and Unreal. But the great thing about tessellation, you know, you play it right, you optimize for it, and then you can have super dense, super tessellated, like dirt or rocks or whatever in front of you on your, you know, your landscape or all that. And it's really highly detailed right in front of you when you're looking at it. But then far off onto the distance, that gets, you know, culled down to, you know, much lower resolution. Maybe the displacement gets culled out at a certain distance. And then a further distance than that, the actual geometry that, you know, before displacement gets, you know, level of detail down.
I'm excited as well to see it appearing in very, very early stages, but in skeletal meshes too now, to form deformable characters.
Oh yeah, I'm excited about that. We'll see. Might take a while.
Tessellation. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I've seen some of the video tests, and it's like definitely version 0.1, but very exciting to see where it's going. Somebody else is asking, where would you want to take your skills to next, or is the gaming industry where you want to stay?
Where do I want to take my skills to next? Probably, you know, bouncing between both. The project that I'm on right now, I'm working with Intrepid Studios on the upcoming game Ashes of Creation. That's probably going to keep me pretty well occupied in the game industry for a while. But I also, you know, I want to start getting into some more virtual production stuff again on the side as well. I like both, and I like both for different reasons. I remember initially one of the things that I wanted to do when breaking into the game industry was actually work on cinematics. And I remember one thing that I remember really strongly was when they showed the very first Diablo 4 trailer at BlizzCon. And I watched that and it was like, oh, this inspires me to want to go more, think about cinematics again. And then the next thing that I did after seeing that was I went and I modeled out, I created a Warhammer scene and then, you know, made a cinematic trailer video inside of that scene, kind of inspired by how the Diablo 4 did it. So I really, really like doing a lot of the blueprint stuff, which is not something that you get to do a lot of on the virtual production side. So that's probably very game centered and oriented there. But then I also really, really like, you know, cinematography I've been over the last year, I've really, really started to dive a lot deeper into cinematography. I have a Netflix approved cinema cam for a webcam right now for this right here. And so having the opportunity to work on some virtual production projects, I think would be really good. But I don't think I'm ever going to lean one way or the other as, my permanent home. Because I really like doing both, being involved in both. And the more that those lines blur, the more and more I'm interested in, doing both of them. But I think if I absolutely had to choose, do or die choose, I think I would choose games, just because I love the interactivity. I love having this like 360 world around you, having open worlds to explore and things like that. And games with current hardware are starting to inch closer and closer and closer to that fully cinematic quality. And I would say we're probably about 15, maybe 20 years at most away from in-game playable graphics being identical to on-screen CGI. So, because the only thing preventing that right now is just hardware. And as fast as hardware is going, I have a 3000 series, RTX card that was amazing, top of the line when I got it, and it's been 4 years and it's outdated now. So yeah.
Moving too fast to keep up with it in some ways, but very exciting to see this amount of innovation going on for sure for me as well. And so there's a lot of talk around this, or a couple things. One being whether the worlds of film and games will converge, and whether we'll be seeing, essentially experiencing movies more than just watching them. That was something I know which was explored during the VR hype bubble of 8 years ago or so, but the hardware was not there back then. It's still progressing. Any thoughts on those two worlds converging?
I definitely see that. I know right now already it's they've converged to a point where the skills are getting so close to each other that I know, unfortunately, to address the elephant in the room, the current state of the game industry with all of these layoffs, really, really sad. I hate seeing, all of my friends here that, they've been laid off and they're wondering what to do next. But virtual production in the film side of things is already a very viable option for them to do. Jumping across industries is not just something that I can do. It's something that I think anybody on any side of it could do, just learning, a couple of extra skills. Now, in terms of them converging for the user experience, I remember when 3D came out, I remember the first Avatar movie, and suddenly every theater was upgraded to 3D. And that was interesting right there. But we, here where I'm at right now in San Diego, just about 6 minutes that way, there is a Regal Edwards movie theater. And they had this thing in there called 4DX. And I experienced it for the first time with Dune 2. Now, cool. What this 4DX is it is a, your seats are, it's like a ride. I felt like I was watching Dune at Disneyland because it's like a ride, and your seats, they move all kinds of different ways, they have things like air that, gets blown at you. They have little things of like water that gets sprayed at you. Not a lot of water, just a little bit of water, and just all kinds of things like that. They have machine like scent machines so that they can change the smell of the room. They actively change the temperature of the room constantly. And so it becomes a very interactive experience. And I remember when we were riding the sandworm and I felt like I was there riding the sandworm myself, because the seats were like, going all over the place. And, the fans were blowing hardcore at us, and you know, it just like everything in there, it felt like being there. I remember, you know, there was a scene where somebody gets shot, because you know, it's not really a spoiler, people get shot. Somebody got shot in the head, mind you, and right when it happened, there was this little thing of air that blew and like shot and like hit me right here in the ear, in timing with the person getting shot on the screen. And it's just like, it took me by surprise. Then there was, you know, somebody gets hurt and there's some blood involved with it. And then I feel this, like just a little bit of water squirt on the back of my neck as if like blood splattered on me. And it was an experience. It was, you know, definitely an experience there. And I feel like I don't know anybody who works on these things, who designs these things, but I feel like it's somebody that's used to both creating these ride experiences at places like Disneyland, but then also maybe somebody who has a little bit of history in the video game industry. And I think of things like that. And then I think about all the things that you can do, you know, with a video game, how virtual production is going with using game engines to be able to, you know, create the experiences that you see. You know, why couldn't that all of this be tied together to, you know, create a bigger experience? I mean, they've been doing this at, you know, Disneyland forever. You know, you go into some of these experiences where you've got the ride, but then you've got, you know, on the screen in front of you, you've got all this other stuff. You know, there are rides, especially if you go to the Galaxy's Edge in Disneyland, you know, there are rides where you get in there and you have four seats and two people have to steer, where one person controls horizontal, one person controls vertical. You have two people back here manning the guns. And then you have this screen, this like LED screen in front of you, showing, you know, like you're flying this thing, you know, through all these obstacles, and you're shooting things and you're trying to avoid obstacles and all of that. And it's just that right there, that you're playing a video game, but it's at the same time, there's the physical aspect of it. And then, you know, you have the visual aspect of it. I just feel like those kinds of experiences are something that could not only get better at places like Disneyland, but also maybe become more common.
So movies become more like more experiential, more like more ride-like, and maybe that may even influence the creative in them. Who knows? Yeah. What I'm glad that you addressed the games industry, the film industry is another one that's gone through an interesting last 6 months to a year as well. What I took from what you were saying was really considering most industries go through hard times at some point or another, that diversifying is a good way of continuing to progress, earn money, and develop your skill sets. Mm-hmm. And I definitely underscore that, having jumped around a little bit as well. And you mentioned simulation. I've spent some time in that area as well. Virtual production and visual effects and interactive. There's so much more that you can do now, right, with computer graphics than 20 years ago. There's so much more opportunity in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, and the thing with simulation is another industry that somebody could bounce to when their primary industry is having some struggles, like what we're going through now. Because I can tell you from working in the simulation side of things, it is not that much different from working in games. The only difference being is that most of the time you're building for VR. So you're just essentially building a game for VR. And so many different skills have transferred between the three industries for me, I know. But I think working in simulation was one of the most important parts of my career, because it taught me how to appreciate optimization, especially working in VR, because you have to reach a certain frame rate to be able to avoid what's called simulation sickness. And when we're building training programs, as well as, you know, like games for marketing purposes and all of that, you know, we got to hit that high frame rate. There's a lot of different ways that you optimize. I learned a lot doing that and then brought that back to the game industry and had just like a bigger understanding of how to get the most out of every little thing. Then I brought that over to virtual production and, you know, once again, how to get the most out of every little thing to pull off these, you know, amazing pieces. The only difference, I think, is how far you can push it graphically, really, to be honest.
That's good. Good for your surviving hard times, also strengthens you as well and over the long term.
Yeah, yeah.
So the other elephant in the room would be what people are referring to a lot as AI and how much that's affecting things, and probably different answers in different industries, but most of it falling into the category of machine learning or neural networks. how much do you see that affecting the industries that you have spent time in today, and what do you think that it will, where do you think it will trend?
I think it affects it pretty heavily, and I think it affects it in a bad way pretty heavily right now, but I also fully believe that there's going to be a comeback. It's going to go full circle. And the reason why I say that is because AI can do a lot of things and it instills a lot of fear, but it still can't really accomplish the same things that a human can. It can only do so much. Now, 100 years from now, hopefully we've all seen Battlestar Galactica. We know where that's going to go. But, right now, I feel like there's a big scare of AI, and you can do a lot. Like there's AI art and everything, but, you know, that works good for, you know, concepts, but I also don't feel like it works that well for finalized concepts of things, because you're still at the mercy of the neural network. You know, it's not as easy as people might think to generate AI art. It's AI art. I see it all the time. It's everywhere. But I mean, me personally, I can tell when it's AI art versus not AI art. See, it's already got me tongue-tied right there, just thinking about AI. But I feel there are a lot of things that still need a human touch. Now, executives that are, you know, in control of budget and layoffs and stuff like that, they may not realize that. They probably have this shiny new toy in front of them that, you know, oh, hey, you know, we don't need a person to do this because we have AI that can do it. But 6 to 18 months from now, they're going to be like, oh, this isn't working. We need to hire people. And the reason why I think that is because AI is powerful, but it can't do what a human can as quickly as a human can. It can't make the change as quickly as a human can, really, you know, to the point of being exactly what like an art director is asking for. Now, I remember, I think it was February of last year, was doing an interview with Meets Myers about AI, and he had a very interesting perspective on it of, you know, it's great as a tool for art directors to be able to get something out there, you know, out of their head and into something visual, but going down the line, it's still going to have to go to an actual concept artist to be able to, you know, translate it to what's going to be necessary. Because is there a make game button? You know, no, there's not. You can't just like push a button and have AI make a game. I mean, it could probably, but it probably also wouldn't be fun. You know, we have Sora. I think that's how it's pronounced.
Yep.
That's able to do movie stuff now, but I feel like you're still at the mercy of its capabilities and you don't have full creativity over it. Yeah. Now AI, I use AI things every day. I don't use like Midjourney or anything like that, but all the new AI tools in Photoshop, Lightroom, Premiere, After Effects, all those things, I take heavy advantage of those. And what they do is they help my workflow. They speed up my workflow, but it's not always perfect. It doesn't always do the best job. And I feel like the big fear with AI is that tools like that, even people are going to be able to come in, they're going to be able to click a button, and that's going to be it. And it's going to do it all for you. But what I've learned from using those tools is you got to click that button 3 or 4 times before it, and you know, change some settings and stuff like that. Like an example would be, I just did a photo shoot the other day, and you know, part of a photo shoot is taking those pictures, you know, into Lightroom and Photoshop, and you know, you're doing some color grading and stuff like that on them. And I used some of the AI tools on one image, and it worked pretty well. But then I used them on the next image and with the same settings, and it didn't work the same. It didn't look right. So I had to go in and I had to tweak some settings and all of that before I could get this AI even to do what I needed it to. Now, it was still faster than doing it manually, but I still believe and I still stand by the only reason why that second image turned out good is because I knew how to do it without AI. So I knew what to look for. I knew what kinds of, I knew the concepts behind kinds of things to tweak to be able to, you know, get it to where I wanted. And then I still had to go in and do a little bit of manual touch up on top of that, you know, a couple sliders here and there. So it's, I think if we embrace them as tools for speeding up our workflow, then it can be very, very helpful. I mean, I would definitely like to see more AI tools that speed up workflow. I mean, who would not like, who in CG would not absolutely die for an AI UV unwrap tool?
I was going to say
that did it perfectly. Nobody likes UV unwrapping, unless you're an environment artist in games, and then you're UVing to trim sheets all the time, and that can actually be kind of fun. But
it can be satisfying when you're close to finishing it. But yeah, if you've got
But you know, it's like if there are tools that can help speed up a process, then I'm all for that because I would like to spend less time on certain processes. But I also always fully believe that, you know, as an artist that would use those tools, you need to understand what's going on in the background. And the reason why is because the AI is not going to do it right every time. So when it does it wrong, if you already know how to do it yourself, you know, if you know what's going on behind the scenes, then you can fix it pretty quickly. But if you don't know that stuff, you could waste hours and hours and hours trying to figure out how to get it to do the thing that you want, when maybe you could have just gone in there and did it manually and, you know, a third of the time.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to dig into that. I know it's a difficult conversation at times. We just literally this afternoon or this morning to this afternoon, there was a 2-hour VES seminar, if you like, about how AI might affect the visual effects community, with a you know, a head of research at Weta and a lawyer that works in the entertainment industry, and some really, really interesting folks talking about what this stuff is, what it's capable of, what it's not capable of, and then some of the kind of side issues around the issues that it has, which are not resolved yet, and maybe some of them will be, but around control and around copyright and around some of those things that are really important to figure out and need to be figured out. But yeah, I think what I took from your take on it is to be aware of it, learn it, and get to know it, and don't be scared of it. That's the best way to
take advantage of it. Make it work for you, because it's unfortunately it's not going away. I know there are some ethical considerations, which I am on the side of, you know, an artist owning their own art, and you know, yep, I am on the side of the artist in that, being an artist myself. But I think a lot of the AI, rather than being scared of it, use it, learn to use it, learn to use it to your advantage. Because if we all get together and we do that, then it's going to show that, oh, hey, yeah, AI can do some stuff, but it can't do it as well as putting a real person at the controls using it. So
artists are the ultimate control freaks too, right? We and the client as well, they want absolute control of what they're producing. And so far in my whole career, where I come down to with this is my whole career making imagery digitally. We've never been able to describe the level of detail that we want through words. We've never been able to accomplish that.
Oh yeah.
So I think this is no different.
Yeah. So many times, you know, I've asked an art director to describe something to me, and then the answer will be like, hold on, let me draw it for you.
Yeah,
and exactly. I think as artists, you know, we are visual people. So being able to like see it visually is important there. But, you know, I've also like been in that position as an art director myself where, you know, somebody has asked me to describe it for them and then I will write it because I'm a writer too. I'll write it and try to describe it out. And they'll be like, okay, this helps, but I still just don't quite see it. Let me draw it for you. And then bam, there we go. So it's, yeah, things like Midjourney and stuff like that, you know, I forget the names of all the others, but they're prompts, you know, you're writing something out. And, you know, if you write something out simple, like, you know, say, make me a dog riding a dolphin through space with the Milky Way in the background. That's already a pretty descriptive thing, but you don't know what you're going to get out of that. Maybe you'll get something good. Maybe you won't, but it probably will not be what you originally had in your head when you wrote that down. Then you go in there and you try to describe it anymore and all these details. I mean, I've never tried to do that myself, but I imagine that's going to be, you know, there's going to be so many details that it's still not going to be able to pick up on. And then at that point, you know, just have a concept artist, tell it to a concept artist and they'll get it right for you.
Absolutely. Well, we'll see where it all goes. Cause the proof will be in what shows up. It's really, really interesting to talk about it and just be real about it. And I appreciate you going through it. I know it's not always an easy topic. As we wrap up, I know we're going to see you soon at NAB and the Virtually Everything Summit, which I'm really looking forward to coming up on this Saturday, if anyone's in Vegas. Yeah, come check it out. And also be seeing you tonight in our games course as well. And maybe shameless plug, you could just mention briefly what you do at CG Pro.
Yeah, so at CG Pro, what I do here largely comes down to bringing games into a school that has traditionally been focused on the virtual production side, really expand it. I teach a class myself on the intro to game dev, trying to get some other people able to teach that as well, and you know, looking into some other classes to expand on the game side. But the biggest thing right now is definitely the intro to game design, which I have a very unique approach, I've been told, where, you know, you go through a lot of courses, especially that are around game design and what you're doing there. Like there's a very specific thing that you're trying to build. You know, it's like I'm building an action RPG or I'm building an adventure game or I'm building a first person shooter. And then they go into all these details and they hold your hand through it. I don't like to do that because when you do a step-by-step tutorial like that, what do you learn? You learn how to follow that specific step-by-step tutorial. Me, I'm all about concepts and critical thinking, which is what the games stuff that we do at CG Pro is all about. So it's, I like to teach the simple steps, the build the Lego pieces, and then learn how to put those Lego pieces together into, you know, different things. And so I've always said that everything complex is just a collection of simple things put together in a certain way. And so what ends up happening with that is basically the students come in, they learn how to build the Lego blocks and then how to put them together in different ways. Then they get challenged to put them together in a different way that they're not handheld through. And then at the end of it, we get a wide range of vertical slice games out of it. You know, we get two-dimensional side scrollers, you know, we get first person shooters, we get adventure games, we get games where you're a cat, we get you know, games where you're a DJ, you know, games where, you know, you're a giant spider, and just all different. So it's not just one, like, here's how to do this one thing. It's all about learning and understanding the concepts so you can make them work for you.
At the end of it, you have a playable game, and some people have, you know, come back and gone through it again to take their game even further, and we've got some finished ones now. Super exciting, and always love the graduation, just seeing people's creativity and transformation as well. And I, yes, Shane, giant robot spider. Indeed. I super appreciate you being a part of CG Pro, and also really appreciate you being here today and sharing your wisdom and insights. We've already shared some of your links in the chat, I know, but any places where people can follow and learn more about what you do with your digital alchemy and other things that you want to share?
Yeah, so I have a company called Digital Alchemy with one of the DBAs as Learn Digital Alchemy. And I've got a YouTube channel, just Digital Alchemy 3D. I think there are some links here in the chat for it. But also I have a course platform on Learn Digital Alchemy that has some pre-recorded courses in there around Unreal Engine, you know, getting started with Unreal Engine, getting started with some world building concepts. I'm actually currently expanding with some game dev stuff. And it's all in an aim to get people comfortable enough in Unreal Engine to be able to then go through, like go to YouTube and actually understand what they're talking about when you're watching tutorials, you know, being able to have some support when you're going through a live class. I know there's one big myth about this course that a lot of people were worried about was, you know, it's, oh, it's like in competition with live training, and it's not. Really, it's not meant to be, because nothing is ever going to beat having a live mentor there. But I do live classes myself at CG Pro, and I use my side course as supplemental. So it's like we go through, like right off the bat, we go through, and first week it's like, okay, we got to learn Unreal Engine, you know, how to get around it and everything, how to do a little bit of world building, all of that really quickly. Second week, you know, we're in there, it's like intro to Blueprint. We got to learn how to work with Blueprint, and it goes so fast. It can be really overwhelming, but that's where something like this course comes in, because they can go through that and just get all those little extra pieces so that they can then, you know, further, you know, further their knowledge along in the class. And it's, I've had several of my students on the live classes actually go and buy my digital alchemy course, my Unreal Engine Pro Masterclass is what I call it, and then use it to learn, like to really get familiarized with some of those, like, basics and foundational skills, so that when they come to labs, they're asking questions about how do I do this, you know, crazy complex thing in Blueprint, instead of, You know, how do I connect nodes again? You know, so it's there to help and supplement that. And that's, it's a lot of stuff that I see a lot of people and places not doing. You know, they'll go through, they'll hold your hand through a step-by-step tutorial, but not tell you the why or help you understand the foundations behind how something works so that when you're debugging it, you know, I don't know how to debug it because I don't understand how these things work together. That's what my course tries to address there.
Awesome. And any other channels or Instagrams or ArtStation or any other places people can follow you?
Yeah, there's a Learn Digital Alchemy Instagram. There's a Facebook page. You can look up John Wainick on ArtStation to find my ArtStation.
Cool.
Obviously, YouTube's a big one. Yeah.
Right.
Also, one thing I'll throw out there is that if anybody does go to my course, which you can find on learndigitalalchemy.com or unrealenginepro.com, there is, if you go there and you use the coupon code CGPRO, it's 25% off.
Perfect. Go check it out, folks. Again, John, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on today. I've been looking forward to this one.
And yeah, it's been fun. I'm glad we finally found the time.
Yeah.
I found absolutely. The time.
Yes. Busy man. Yeah, well, hopefully we get to have you back. Again, there's way more I wanted to talk about, but I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day, and thank you also to all of our listeners. Thanks for joining us and asking great questions, and we will be back in 2 weeks. If you enjoyed today, you can follow us again at becomecgpro.com, find out more about the school CGPro. We have open days every month, so you can come check us out and join live, experience a live lesson for free, and just check us out. We have those every month, so if you check out the website, you'll find those. And just keep making great art and learning and growing. That's my mantra. Look forward to seeing you all again. And
yeah, yes, if anybody's going to be at NAB, then look us up. We'll be there.
Yeah, we'll be at View Studios. I know there's some links went out in the chat there as well. View Studios on Saturday for the Virtually Everything Summit, and also several things on the floor. So come and say hi, and we'll see you in Vegas. For those that aren't in Vegas, we'll see you again in a couple of weeks. All right. Take care, everybody. See you all soon.